Hey everyone, Peter started a new job recently, so he's too busy to do an episode this week. So we are going to finally release this episode that we recorded back in like January. So hope you enjoy it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of Neighbor Science. I think, are we on season 25, episode 423 now? I've lost count.
Well, we've been recording pretty much every day this week, so kind of seems like it.
It's all just one. I mean, basically, we should just, at this stage, we should just not switch off our mics anymore and just keep recording everything.
Yeah. Also, I think we should, like every episode we release will be a new season. So that way, when someone comes to see the show for the first time, then they'll be like, wow, they have like 20 seasons. That's really impressive. They must be really good at this. Then they'll listen for sure.
Yeah, and then they'll listen and they'll be like, holy shit, mind blown. This show is like the greatest podcast in the history of podcasting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. We will name all our shows as seasons from now on. Maybe only until the end of the episode, though.
Right. So, I'm Ryan.
Hi, guys.
Salisbury.
I'm Peter.
Rough to a great start today.
Ryan is having some technical difficulties, and by technical difficulties, I mean that he
I've
is
been
swearing
screaming at my computer all morning, and my
at.
phone, and every other piece of technology around me, because it all fucking sucks.
Yeah, we've decided we're going to do a future episode on how much technology sucks. But we're going to wait for Ryan to calm down a bit before we do that because,
I am
yeah,
red
we
and
don't want.
mad and nude today.
I'm very disturbed by the red and mad and nude part. Like, please don't switch your camera on throughout this episode. I need to look at the screen, and I'm as everyone knows, cis hetero, homophobe. So,
Peter's just doing a
yeah.
little podcasting joke since you guys can't see what's actually happening. I've had my webcam on the whole time, so he's being ironic right now. He doesn't want me to switch it off.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
me. Yeah, maybe. Okay. So today we're going to be discussing one of my pet projects over the last few years. I'm not obviously going to go into full detail on everything because I have literally read about 1,500 plus maybe papers on the subject,
Damn.
and there's a lot out there, and most of it, I'll be dead honest, focuses on very small cases. It doesn't look at the broader picture, and so it's I've spent several years filling in little details at a time with a lot of repetition throughout everything. So yeah, the subject for today's podcast is going to be adhocracy.
It's a funny
Is
name.
Ryan's? Yeah. It's an awesome name. So ad hoc obviously means created or done for a particular purpose as necessary, which is what basically got me interested in the concept to begin with. I have major issues with the concept of bureaucracy. I find it inefficient. I find it clumsy. It is unnecessarily large. It is restrictive. It is the mainstay of government around the world.
It turns people into flies.
Yes. So I have major issues with the concept of bureaucracy, and several years ago I started taking a good solid look at what are the alternatives. And it turned out that there actually isn't all that much in the way of alternatives.
How about this one, Peter? The free market. You ever think of that, buddy?
I'm sorry, just.
No, because you're a statist. That's why.
I'm sorry, just one second. I need to swallow the vomit that is now in my mouth. The concept of the free market is easily the stupidest thing on the planet.
Business is bureaucracy. Like, it literally is bureaucracy. It's not. Yeah. It's not. I'm not using a metaphor. It literally is bureaucracy.
We're not being ironic or anything like that now.
It exactly fits the definition of bureaucracy.
Yes.
Because it is.
Okay. So, because you're going to hear mostly from me droning on and on about adhocracy in a bit, Ryan, I asked you to take a look at bureaucracy so that we have a bit more balance in the episode, that it's not just purely focused on adhocracy on its own. Can you maybe give a short bit on bureaucracy?
Yeah. So we all are familiar with bureaucracy, you know, the DMV, bunch of other stuff, probably. I don't know. That's probably the only one, though. Bureaucracy is a form of administration that has been around for as long as states have, and it basically involves administration by non-elected officials. And they make policy, and so the policies are written out and people follow them. They're in a sort of like a chain of command. In fact, I'll read Max Weber's definition of bureaucracy. It's characterized by hierarchical organization, formal lines of authority, as in a chain of command, a fixed area of activity, a rigid division of labor, regular and continuous execution of assigned tasks, all decisions and powers specified and restricted by regulations, officials with expert training in their fields, career advancement dependent on technical qualifications, and qualifications evaluated by organizational rules, not individuals. So Weber has the most thorough theory of bureaucracy. I have not read it myself yet. I plan to get to it
someday. Oh, don't. It is ridiculously fucking boring.
Oh, yeah. Good to know.
And kind of look, if you want to understand bureaucracy so that you can figure out how to do it better or how to propose an alternative to it or whatever, then it's useful in that sense. But I cannot think of any way in which it should be propagated throughout society where that's a desirable outcome. So the fewer people that actually go on and read it in that sense, the better off I think society is going to be. I think we need a few individuals to read it so that they can figure out what else to do, and then it needs to be put into a museum, and that's about it.
Well, I already bought every Weber book for my Kindle that I almost never use for $1, so going to get my money's worth someday.
Again, absolutely fantastic if you're struggling to sleep.
Okay. So some views on bureaucracy. There's quite a few differing views, so I'm going to go over a couple of them. Kafka famously wrote a lot about bureaucracy, and the general theme in his writing is that bureaucracy can grow into a sprawling maze of intractable, contradictory hierarchies that dehumanize those that interact with it.
Yeah. I like him.
Yeah. So, you know, you go to interact with the bureaucracy, and then, you know, you try to follow their rules, and then, you know, you submit your form or, you know, talk to the person or whatever, and they tell you, like, oh, you did this wrong, do this instead. So you do that thing instead. They say, oh, no, you still did it wrong. Start all over again. Or, like, you know, that decision isn't up to me. Or, like, even though you have extenuating circumstances, it doesn't matter because this is the rule that we use. Yeah, there's Kafka. Weber believed bureaucracy is actually the most efficient and rational way to organize human activity, but in excess, it threatens individual freedom. He listed preconditions for the emergence of bureaucracy, including an increase in the amount of space and population being administered, an increase in the complexity of the administrative tasks being carried out, and the existence of a monetary economy requiring a more efficient administrative system. So notice that that implies that business is a form of bureaucracy, which it is.
Yeah.
David Graeber, the anarchist anthropologist, wrote The Utopia of Rules, which I read. It's a pretty good book. Mm-hmm. His general view is that it's not clear whether or not there is an adequate replacement for bureaucracy. I don't think he talked about adhocracy at all in the book, but I haven't read it in like 3 years, I think. I got it like as soon as it came out and read it immediately. So it's been a while. But it usually strips both the members of the bureaucracy and those interacting with it of the ability to act rationally, and can become a, as he called it, a tyranny of nobody, which is the whole it's not up to me situation. He argues that the order and regularity of bureaucracy is more harmful than valuable, and elaborates that rules do not apply equally in practice and are more instruments through which human imagination is smashed and shattered.
Yeah. I recently posted on Twitter saying that I regularly come across rules that I don't understand. And that's understandable, since I'm not aware of the situations that led to their creation. But surely the people that enforce those rules should be able to explain them. I mean, how can you enforce a rule that you don't understand? And this is what I have found throughout my life. The most frustrating element of bureaucracy is that people are blindly applying and enforcing rules that they don't understand. They don't understand the reason or the context for which in which those rules were created. And if you don't understand it, you're and almost guaranteed to apply the rule or enforce the rule incorrectly.
Yeah. So that's part of that. I mentioned organizational inertia a couple episodes ago. I think that's part of it. You know, there's always going to be some amount of churn in any organization. There's going to be new members coming and going, you know, old members or existing members being put into different positions. So, there's that aspect where, you know, the person coming in wasn't around necessarily when that rule was created and did not, you know, wasn't there to understand the context. And then also there's that context of, you know, the rule and its intent, which can easily change. This kind of thing happens all the time at my job, where we're essentially creating computerized bureaucracy, because it's like, most large scale web apps kind of fit that description. They're really just, machines to fill in forms. And so they're just computerizing the process of filling in forms. And so there's all these rules that, you know, unless they're well documented, which they almost never are, you're not going to understand the intent of it. And so you have to either refer back to, the documents that went into their creation, or you have to, talk to someone who was there when it was created, or just kind of make it up and interpret it, the way that you would. But in more, rigorous bureaucracies, you know, that becomes more difficult, because you have very little agency yourself, especially if you're, you know, near the bottom of the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So the last one I have is Ludwig von Mises, our favorite guy.
Yeah, he's such a cool guy, man. So cool.
I have a great joke that references an old cartoon about his name. I'm going to tear this Mises to pieces. Yeah. I'm very clever.
I like it.
I know.
I want that on a t-shirt.
So in his 1944 work Bureaucracy, very clever name, good job there. Von Mises compared bureaucratic management to profit management. Profit management, he argued, is the most effective method of organization when the services rendered may be checked by economic calculation of profit and loss. Yeah, that thing that actually exists. When, however, the service in question cannot be subjected to economic calculation, bureaucratic management is necessary. He did not oppose universally bureaucratic management. I think that means he did not universally oppose bureaucratic management. On the contrary, he argued that bureaucracy is an indispensable method for social organization, for it is the only method by which law can be made supreme and is the protector of the individual against despotic arbitrariness.
Even though bureaucracy, by definition, is despotic arbitrariness.
Oh, yeah. Also, man, every time I see something like the law can be made supreme, I'm just getting like racist dog whistles running through my head.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you consider how many laws that exist today were essentially conceptualized during highly racist regimes, not that regimes today are very egalitarian or anything, but I mean, Jim Crow laws are still in evidence in the US today. Okay, we're not here to talk about law specifically today.
That's up to Mike Dicta.
Okay, so that's a basic rundown of what bureaucracy is and how it's viewed by some popular theorists throughout history. Yeah.
Actually, I will add one more thing because it's something that I was thinking about yesterday. So this is my perspective on bureaucracy, which is that all bureaucracy requires some sort of de-skilling. So in order to have a hierarchy of people manage anything, there has to be some sort of de-skilling to the process because, you know, if the people at the bottom have to be highly skilled, then the managers that are over them have very little power to control them because they won't have the expertise necessary to direct them or to, you know, push back against any choice that or decision that they make that they disagree with. So there always has to be some sort of either reductive outlook on the world or reductive reasoning. There's just no way to capture all the nuances of managing a process in a way that a hierarchy can deal with. So I think that's an important characteristic of bureaucracy and especially of hierarchical organization.
Yeah. Okay, and that actually your point leads perfectly into how I'd like to start discussing adhocracy. Now, back in 2013, there was a paper written by M. Pitesa and S. Thau. I'm not sure where they are based or what their specific fields are, but they wrote a paper called Masters of the Universe, How Power and Accountability Influence Self-Serving Decisions Under Moral Hazard. And
does it have anything to do with He-Man?
I really wish it did, but unfortunately, I mean, that's what I was searching for at the time. And I stumbled onto this. But yeah. Basically, what happened is that in a trio of experiments, Marco Pitesa and he's from Grenoble's École de Management and
Management.
That's how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
And Stefan Thau of the London Business School, In a trio of experiments, they found that people who expected to be judged on the results of their decisions were far more likely to abuse the trust placed in them than were people who expected to be judged on the procedures they used to reach their decisions. So, what this showed was that people who believe that the ends justify the means, or believe that that is what they will be judged on, is whether or not the ends justify the means, are more likely to use whatever means in order to achieve the ends that they are set. Those who
consequentialism actually bad.
Yes.
Interesting.
That's essentially, if you want to put it into two words, consequentialism bad. If you want to boil it down.
We're actually deontologists now.
Yes, deontology. Okay, so now this might seem like a strange bit of trivia, but it boils down to people in power being less likely to abuse their power if we are applying the correct system to validate their power, to give them power, to exercise their power. Now, with that bit of trivia there, I'm now going to just explain a little bit more about adhocracy and then see how this all fits in. Now, since the 1920s, Max Weber's theories of bureaucratic public administration have supported the capitalist state quite strongly. But more recently, postmodern public management theory, which can actually be traced back to Woodrow Wilson and even further back to Friedrich Nietzsche, has become more prevalent than Weber's theories in supporting the capitalist state. Now, personally, when it comes to management, which is what this all really falls under, I prefer to look at the work of people like Henry Mintzberg, which you may recall I mentioned during our episode with Blair Fix.
Yep.
Okay. Now, he deems bureaucratic management as too slow to adapt to a fast-changing world. Mintzberg doesn't specifically look at public management, but rather at management in general. Now, he developed, although he didn't create originally, what is known as the competing values framework, in which organizational culture can be classified into four distinct types. And these types are hierarchy, market, clan, and adhocracy. Now, just a quick brief explanation of what each of these is. In a hierarchy culture, the hierarchy has a traditional approach to structure and control that flows from a strict chain of command, as in Weber's original view of bureaucracy. For many years, this was considered the only effective way of organizing and is still a basic element of the vast majority of organizations. Hierarchies have respect for position and power, and they often have well-defined policies, processes, and procedures. And hierarchical leaders are typically coordinators and organizers who keep a close eye on what's happening. So that's just a broad strokes, that's hierarchy from an organizational cultural perspective. Then you've got the market culture. Now, the market organization also seeks to control, but does so by looking outward and in particularly taking note of transaction cost. It's important to note that the market organization is not one which is focused just on marketing, but one where all transactions, internal and external, are viewed in market terms. So transactions are exchanges of value. In an efficient, efficient market organization, value flows between people and stakeholders with minimal cost and delay. Market cultures are outward looking. Inward and outward looking are specific terms within management research. Relatively easy to understand. Outward looking doesn't focus so much on internal procedures. Internal looking doesn't focus so much on outward results. So market cultures are outward looking, and are particularly driven by results and are often very competitive. Leaders in market cultures are often hard-driving competitors who seek always to deliver the goods. It's always about making that bottom line. Okay, so that's market culture. Then you've got clan culture. Now, the clan organization has less focus on structure and control and a greater concern for flexibility. Rather than strict rules and procedures, people are driven through vision, shared goals, outputs, and outcomes. In contrast to hierarchies, clans often have very flat organizations, and people and teams act more autonomously. It has an inward focus and a sense of family, and people work well together, strongly driven by loyalty to one another, and essentially the shared cause. Rules in clan cultures, although not necessarily documented, do still exist and are often communicated socially. So it's slightly less formal, but it can be a very strict because it is an informal social system.
I was following this until I noticed that clan is spelled with a K, which it seems kind of racist to me.
I never ever spotted that. It's because I'm white, so yeah. The K is always changed.
Got
to
a lot
C
of privilege there.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Okay. Now I can't read anything further without picturing it, because now the very next sentence is clan leaders act
clan grand wizards act in a facilitative supportive way.
So clan organizational clan fuck, I can't say this at all now. You fucked me up, Ryan.
Yes.
Okay, so the leaders in a clan organizational culture still doesn't work. They act in a facilitative, supportive way, and they may take on a kind of parental role. So obviously, although it doesn't strictly mean family business, it does imply a familial kind of bond between people within the business. You know that your dad is the boss of the house in the nuclear family model, but at the end of the day, mom has equal power as dad, and when it comes to doing a family outing and you're setting up a tent while camping, everyone has to pitch in and do their share equally, and everyone is trusted to do their job properly. Obviously, anyone who's gone camping with their family knows that this is not how it actually works, but that's pretty much the closest analogy. Now, adhocracy culture. The adhocracy culture has even greater independence and flexibility than the clan culture, which is necessary in a rapidly changing business climate. Where market success goes to those with greatest speed and adaptability, the adhocracy will rapidly form teams to face new challenges. It will use prototyping and experimenting rather than long big bang projects and development. Leaders in an adhocracy are visionary, innovative entrepreneurs who take calculated risks to make significant gains. Just to be clear, Mintzberg's work doesn't focus on anything within the field of the public sector. Everything he's done has been to research companies, private firms, he's basically looked at corporate cultures. However, although there is obviously significant differences between public and private enterprise, people are still people, and these cultures are indicative of how people relate to each other within an organization. And that can be applied to just about any situation. Okay. You with me so far?
I am.
Oh, no, I was talking to the audience. I keep forgetting they can't answer back.
They actually can now, because we have a Gmail account, neighborscience@gmail.com. So go ahead and shoot us an email if you have any questions or, you know, rants, anything like that. Also, answer Peter's question, because he asked you, and it's rude to not respond.
Yeah, yeah. Come on, guys. Like, seriously.
So okay, just no. Answer with yes or no. Just nothing else. No subject header. Just yes or no.
That won't be confusing for us at all.
We're going to ask a couple more yes or no questions in this episode. So we expect to get some answers.
Yeah. I demand answers. Okay. Now, given the rapid changes we see in today's technological world, I would recommend the implementation of ad hoc institutions within a confederated libertarian municipalist framework, which would obviously need to be facilitated by open source software dedicated to liquid, direct, democratic public participation in public administration and management. And fortunately, this already exists. There is a platform called, there's software called Adhocracy. Some of the people that use it also call it Liquid Adhocracy or just Liquid. And it's essentially a decision-making platform that allows anyone who is participating to provide their opinion, to suggest amendments, to vote up, vote down. It's a very clever piece of software designed specifically to facilitate ad hoc governance.
We use Lumio for the DC DSA electoral caucus, which is sort of similar, but the caucus is technically a bureaucracy because it's a persistent organization, although we do form working groups that I think would be classified as adhocracy.
Perfect. So, I mean, it's not like the stuff doesn't exist at all yet and that it can't exist. It's just that it's not being implemented outside of individual organizations internally. It's not being used at
scale. Bureaucracy is better for managing power, which is the goal of most social activity today, whereas adhocracy would be better for actually doing something.
Yeah. Okay, now, to summarize the main findings in the research I've done so far, essentially, let me just break this down for you quickly. Adhocracy is a form of direct democracy that makes all institutions temporary. That is so important in the understanding of this concept, because my main issue with bureaucracy is how long it lasts. It outlasts everything and it sucks. And so it sucks for a really fucking long time. Whereas with adhocracy, when something sucks, you form a council, you fix the problem. And once it's fixed, you dissolve the council. If it is not fixed within a specific time frame, you form a new council who tries a new approach, and you keep retrying until you fix the problem. Once the problem is fixed, there's no more need for that ongoing institution. For stuff that needs longevity, what's needed is not a long-term institution, but a long-term fix, if that makes sense. By the way, for those that were paying attention, that was another yes or no question.
Yeah, I'm not answering these anymore. It's up to you guys.
Yeah. This is up to the audience. I've secretly given Ryan a hand signal saying that he's not allowed to answer my questions. Mm-hmm. Okay, so councils are created with the purpose of solving a problem or creating a specific piece of legislation and are disbanded once the problem is either solved or a time limit is reached. If the problem has not been solved, a new council is formed to attempt to find a solution. If solutions are found to be harmful, then a council can be formed to undo the harm. And this is the big difference between bureaucracy and adhocracy, is that adhocracy can correct problems, whereas bureaucracy will tend to perpetuate the problem. So, adhocracies require that a malleable constitution be agreed upon that can be altered without requiring a large bureaucratic body's approval. But that cannot be inherently paradoxical or self-contradicting. Now, when I first mentioned this to Ryan, we were busy working on something that we will discuss in a later episode. Ryan developed a political economy concept he calls transferics, and I developed an overarching concept for community organization called the VIAC. And yeah, we'll talk about that some other time. But now, as part of the transferics work, I think it was when we were first discussing adhocracy that this came up. Ryan solved the constitution problem with a clever little system that he calls Lawtran. Now, in my notes here, I've basically copied and pasted what Ryan originally wrote about Lawtran.
A lot of which I probably currently disagree with.
Okay, so instead of just reading what he wrote, I'm rather going to ask if, A, Ryan, do you still agree with the concept of Lawtran?
Yeah, I think in principle it's still a good idea. How about I just explain the concept first so that people know what I'm agreeing or disagreeing with?
Sure.
So the basic idea is to decentralize the power of law, to bring the power of organization and law into the hands of normal people who don't have time to, you know, understand you know, all of the different laws that apply to them, who, you know, may not be as good at rigorous writing as, you know, a professional lawyer. And so the idea is to create a framework for writing legal documents that's, you know, what you would write is very simple, like, you know, computer script, and what actually turns out is much more complex and is, you know, based on like vetted legal writing. So instead of trying to write a full legal document yourself, you would sort of just like take parts that have already been written by others and sort of put them together so that, you know, you understand what you're putting together, even if what would actually be in the official document is completely arcane and intractable to you. And part of this would be to follow the like the open source GitHub model, where projects are sort of built on top of one another, and there's like a certain degree of modularity, so that once a part is built in one place, you know, parts of it can be taken out from there and plugged into new projects that, you know, may not exactly fit, but, you know, they have some shared useful bits that can be reused.
Okay.
So now I do know that I disagree with the first sentence here, which is modern radicals seem to avoid the issue of legal power because that has changed. I think when it was written, it was probably true, but today I think, you know, contemporary radicals are very much engaged in legal power and, you know, organizing within the framework of the state and, you know, national and local government.
Okay. Moving on, adhocracy fosters both innovation and performance. There are so many studies that have been done on various organizations showing that ad hoc organizations outperform every other kind of organization when it comes to innovation. And depending on what your metrics for measurement are, to some extent, performance. So your market cultures tend to produce more goods, but that's not a good metric for performance, in my opinion, because then you're going for quantity rather than quality. The moment you start looking for quality goods, you need an ad hoc culture to get the best results. Some of the main values of this form of governance are creativity, a risk-taking attitude, freedom, flexibility, all of which you can understand why it would not fit in with most states' idea of governments, of governance. They don't like risk taking in that sense. Although, if you look at the healthcare industry, pharmaceutical industry specifically, at the end of the day, they don't really fund, or they are not generally funded by the private sector. They're generally funded by governments. And
yeah, I would say governments they avoid political risk taking, as in looking bad, but in terms of spending, they are very what's the opposite of averse? they're very willing to go to take risks with spending because their governments, they can't go insolvent.
Yeah. They get to make money.
Yeah.
By definition. So, so adhocracy requires that little bit of a risk-taking attitude. You've got to be willing to try new stuff. You've got to be willing to say, okay, well, we need the best people for the job. This is essentially the job. We don't really know what the outcomes are going to be, but fuck it, let's try something. And yeah, that's one of the reasons why it tends to be more innovative, is because people are more willing to take risks that can lead to solutions rather than long-term profits. Okay. So strong adhocracy governance reinforces the positive association between proactive personality and intentions to start, organize, and manage any initiative, as well as a disinclination towards seeking the permanence of that initiative, which I feel quite strongly about. I can never remember who said it, but I read once somewhere that any organization created out of fear must itself create fear to justify its own existence. And this is always
Obama.
Yeah, wise man, wise man. Thanks, Obama.
Still my president.
Yeah, still my Hillary. I mean president. So the whether this is empirically true or not, I can't say. I haven't done any research, but it makes sense to me that if you create an institution specifically to deal with an element of fear, once that fear is gone, no one's going to be okay with you keeping up the issue. A good example, I think, is the Patriot Act, and how there was a lot of fear-mongering around that. And then by the time people got fed up with the war and everything that was being done in the name of the Patriot Act, the fear was gone. not gone, but
so they invented ISIS, which doesn't actually exist.
Well, yeah. And I hate to break it to people, but ISIS was, and I know everyone thinks it's a terrorist organization, but it's not. Okay, ISIS is a coffee shop about 10 blocks away from me right now. that is specifically named after the Egyptian god. So
it's ISIS actually also it's also a hardcore band.
Oh, really?
Yes, they're pretty good, actually.
Sweet, nice.
Yeah, they've been around for longer than the so-called terrorist organization that's as much of a hoax as the moon.
did you mean moon or moon landing?
No, the moon.
Okay. Not, yeah, because I was gonna say moon landing real, moon not so much.
Yeah, they landed on the Stanley Kubrick movie studio, which is the moon.
The funniest thing about the Stanley Kubrick conspiracy theory for me has always been that Stanley Kubrick was so into realism that he did film the moon landing, but because of his dedication to realism, he made them all go to the moon to do it.
So I think another good example, actually, of fear being used to perpetuate an organization dependent on fear is just the state itself, because the state's rule, as many have pointed out, violence isn't the most critical tool of control for the state. It can't just use violence on everyone all the time. That's completely impractical and would absolutely cause revolt. The real main tool of the state is the fear of the threat of violence that is implied by its more selective use of violence on people who actually do try to resist the state's rule. And so there's a long history. I mean, we have, terrorists now are the sort of manufactured threat from the state, but there's a long history of, in every state, of threats being manufactured. Most commonly barbarians, the people who live outside of the state, are drummed up as some sort of threat to the livelihood of the state. And so they're used as the justification for the rule of the state.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And I think I would, I guess policing would also be included there. If we see, random people getting arrested for, whatever, then the idea is that it's supposed to deter us from doing the thing that they got arrested for.
Yeah, I think another good example is, whenever there's a very low approval rating for institutions like police forces, immediately you start to go and look at your news agencies and there's a strong surge in reportings of muggings, of theft, of murder, so that people are afraid of stepping outside without strong police presences. And I do remember reading an article about it at some point. But right now, I couldn't even begin to know where to look for that. Someone had actually done the research, and it correlated quite strongly. Mm-hmm. Basically, there are five dynamic network patterns that are found that underlie successful ad hoc collaboration. The first is identification of heterogeneous network actors and early alignment of interests. Basically saying that you need diversity. And then once you've figured out that you've got enough diversity, you need to make sure that everyone sort of, the end goals align with what everyone is looking to achieve. Which, it's not rocket science. Then the second one is the development of a shared vision for heterogeneous goals. So everyone has to be on board with achieving more than just their own individual little objective. They have to be willing to work towards everyone's objectives. This is something that is a major drawback with bureaucracy. If I think of the U.S. Congress and its partisan lines and how no one is willing to work together, except on the issues that sort of are always pro-business, and then suddenly everyone is working together quite hand in hand and happily skipping down the yellow brick road. Another important bit is the use of boundary objects. Now, a boundary object is any object that is part of multiple social worlds and facilitates communication between them. So in this context, it would mean those elements of commonality that exist between all members of a problem-solving council. Now, I theorize that participation in a council, as well as weighting of members' input to the council, would be determined by their centrality to the core problem. Since I first heard Ryan use the word centrality, it's become central to my existence. centrality essentially means how close are you to that subject. To use an example, if the problem being faced by a community is that they need to decide on where to place wind turbines within a community, the people that are going to be most affected by the decision, as well as the people best suited to understanding all the variables associated with the decision, as well as the manufacturers, everyone that is most closely involved with the problem should be involved in producing the solution. At the moment, what happens under bureaucracy is that we select a representative to go and sit in a room full of other representatives that isn't necessarily qualified to even so much as speak about a given topic without having a massive legislative brief being written that's 5,000 pages long, and they need to get through it in under a week, and they don't really understand the nuances, and they need entire teams of people to help them understand it and write them briefs so that they can talk about it. And at the end of the day, the people that are most affected by the decisions being made have no say whatsoever in the actual decision being made. So in adhocracy, your council would be working based on centrality. So everyone that is involved in the decision are people that are either going to majorly affect that decision or be affected by that decision. So you've got a vastly different situation to what you have currently under bureaucracy. The fourth dynamic network pattern that you find that underlies successful ad hoc collaboration is punctual directness and distance among implementing actors. Now, it sort of relates to the whole centrality concept in that, first of all, we're talking geographical. If I am in London and I'm making a decision that affects London, then someone in Beijing or Washington has much less say, like, shut the fuck up. You don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You don't understand the local culture. You don't understand the minutia of the situation. Stop thinking that you know what to fucking say. Shut the fuck up, Mr. Cheeto, and stop telling us what to do with our little situation here. So
it's a good traditional Chinese name there, Cheeto.
Yeah. okay, so geographical, first of all, but then it's also social. If you try and get a far right winger to make a decision that is going to be implemented by a strong left wing socialist, you're not going to have a good time. And we can see this happening all over the world constantly, where people that are from too broad a political spectrum are trying to A, make a decision and hand it down to someone on the other end of the spectrum who is not going to agree with the recommended implementation. They're not going to agree on anything. And so there's not much point in setting up that kind of institution that is not going to be effective. What's more effective is if the people involved are part of the council that makes the decision, and that they not be too distant. That, first of all, I'm not saying that you can't have right-wingers involved in a council that also has left-wingers. That obviously would render politics completely, it would stop the entire ad hoc process. You'd be stuck in a stalemate forever. What I am saying is that the centrality of someone to the issue would determine whether or not they get a seat on that council. So if this the required solution is a left-wing solution, if what you're talking about is providing free healthcare to a set part of the community and how to do that, it makes no sense at that point to bring in a right-winger who's saying, well, fuck that, no free healthcare, we want to double charge everyone for everything. It doesn't make sense for them to even have a seat on that council, because they're going to bring in a philosophy that doesn't gel with what is actually being done. Does that make sense, or am I rambling?
I guess I would say just disenfranchise right-wingers until they become post-scarcity anarchists, and then they can have a say.
That actually is a lot more succinct. Okay. The last thing is, what you need is intense local integration of the focal actor. So there are representatives in the U.S. Congress that represent a state that they are not from, that they are not a part of the local communities, they are not invested in any of the issues that are being faced by community members. And so they've been selected as a representative because of party affiliations. But that doesn't help. It doesn't solve the problem. What you need is someone who is going to work towards the solution because they have a vested interest in that solution. And the only way to do that is to have intense local integration. So Native American tribal land and decisions about what happens on that land should never involve anyone that isn't part of the Native American Council. Obviously, people, if what they're trying to do is figure out how to solve a problem of coyotes dying out on that land, yeah, you'll get a biologist in that knows their stuff when it comes to coyotes, but that person's opinion isn't going to outweigh the opinion of someone else on the council who is Native American and has a history of knowledge of the local area and the issues that are faced by the local area. So, just to summarize quickly again, diverse network of actors and the alignment of everyone's interests with the overall goals, the development of diverse goals, into a single shared vision, the use of boundary objects, the punctual directness of both philosophical knowledge and geographical distance among implementing actors, and then the intense local integration of the people that are going to be making decisions. Once you've got those five dynamic network patterns in place, you're more than likely to have successful ad hoc collaboration.
Cool.
Cool. Okay. I don't have much more. I do want to say that a resilient social ecological system may make use of a crisis as an opportunity to transform a more desire into a more desired state. So ad hoc governance, these systems often self-organize as social networks with teams and actor groups that draw on various knowledge systems and experiences for the development of a common understanding and policies and that kind of thing. So the emergence of bridging organizations, I'll say that with air quotes, seem to lower the costs of collaboration and conflict resolution. And enabling legislations and policies can support self-organization while framing creativity for ad hoc co-management efforts. This is literally taken directly out of a paper that has influenced me quite extensively. Basically, what it comes down to is we tend to see that social networks, and I don't mean social media networks, I mean social networks, will tend to arise whenever there's some sort of crisis that's busy happening. They are an emergent property of crises. And they tend to form these bridging organizations that then lower the costs. And again, cost here is not, I'm not talking about economic costs necessarily, although those are included. The costs socially, politically, personally are lowered by these bridging organizations when it comes to collaboration and to resolving conflicts. And when you have enabling legislation and policies that already support self-organization, it works out better. Your ad hoc systems are more likely to be effective then. So ad hocracy seems to be the best suitable form of governance for especially service-based economies, according to the research. And this is based on the strength of ad hoc governance within companies that actually servitize. This sort of lends to the idea that we're already seeing about 60% of the global economy is now service-based, especially in the Western world. Most of what people spend their money on is services. There's less purchasing of products and more purchasing of services. And within the service industry, the service sector of the economy, you can then say that adhocracy is what produces the highest quality of services. So if it's already so effective within the private sector, within corporations globally, within everything from small businesses to multinational corporations, it starts to become obvious that it can and should be applied to governance within the public sector. Last thing is that adhocracy has managed to act as a synthesis of hierarchical bureaucracy and market-based cultures in India. A lot of the research that I've read focuses on individual countries or regions. And one of the interesting ones is India, because of the very, very rich history of Indian cultures and the diversity there, and then the later colonization by the British and how they introduced a very strong market-based culture, and how they fused a very strict hierarchical bureaucracy over the country for a long time. What's happened is that adhocracy has sort of emerged as a means to fuse the concept of traditional bureaucracy as well as the market economy that has come up since British occupation. And it has actually helped to overcome the clash of Western and traditional cultures and the various paradoxes created by these two cultures clashing within one nation. So adhocracy doesn't just help us to govern better and more efficiently, but can actually serve as a way to bridge the gap between traditional cultures and modern cultures that are currently struggling to meet eye to eye. It provides a platform where people can solve problems and move on. And I think that's important.
When you brought up India, you reminded me of something I heard on, I think it was Ari Shafir's Skeptic Tank. He was talking to someone who was like a travel blogger or something like that. And the guy was talking about getting a flat in India. I can't remember what city it is, but it's famously bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. So maybe you know what it is. But anyway, he said in the process of getting a flat there, he had to go and get this document signed by, like, I think he said like 109 different police stations or something like that, in order to like get permission to get a flat there. It was crazy.
That's interesting. I should definitely
Calcutta, maybe.
Entirely possible. Entirely possible. I don't want to say one thing or the other. You know, take a specific stance one direction or the other.
I'll be the wrong one here.
Well, I think once my wife listens to this episode, I promise you she will correct any mistakes we make in regards to India. Okay, so that's me talking about adhocracy and why I think it is a good system for fitting with my preferred political ideology of libertarian municipalism and communalism and social ecology. I think that if we had a libertarian municipalist society where everything follows the confederalist framework of having independent municipalities, each of these could be,
and states' rights, right?
Yeah. That's totally. Woo! I love states' rights. And yeah, people who know me know how much I love states' rights. Oh God, I need to stop vomiting in my mouth.
So yeah, hierarchy bad, working groups good.
Yes. And I'm just waiting for the person to go, yeah, that sounds like communism as done by the Soviet Socialist councils, and it killed a whole bunch of people. It
killed 10 billion people. So
yeah,
but you feel pretty bad about talking about this academic subject now, don't you?
Yeah, I feel terrible, especially once I've also read some stuff about Winston Churchill. For those of you who don't know, please go read up on Winston Churchill. I'm not going to say anything more on the subject because we'll just end up and I'm going to get angry and I'm going to throw stuff around and I don't want to do that.
Yep. We'll do an episode about it sometime.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll wait for an angry day.
Yep.
Do you know what? We'll do it on the same day that we talk about how much tech sucks because that's going to be an angry day. Okay. Any questions?
That was an audience thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you want them to email you. Yeah.
Okay. I want them to email me lots of questions and also go through the episode again and catch all the yes or no questions I've asked and answer them, please. Just a yes or a no. I don't need any context. I'm
clairvoyant. Send them as separate emails. Do not write out a list that's numbered.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, please. No, people,
just send them as separate emails.
I'm so lonely that I want that reaffirmation of who I am. So if you could
I'm going to set up the Gmail so that every time it receives an email, it forwards it automatically to Peter's account.
Yes.
So that he gets every single email.
Woohoo! Yeah. I'm so excited, and I just can't hide.
All right, so... I guess it's time for plugs now, huh?
Are we still doing those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got to.
yeah, I suppose. Look, for those who are getting bored with our plugs, the only reason we still do them is because of the 1,000 new followers we get every single day.
Yeah,
and
they don't know.
They don't know where to find us, even though they found us. We're sneaky, sly ninjas. And yeah, so if you want to find us on Facebook, you can find us on the Neighbor Science page. Ryan's better at telling us about the Twitter stuff.
All right. It's facebook.com/neighborscience. Twitter is at NeighborSciPod. That's the Neighbor Science official Twitter account. I am at handle of Rye, without the E. Peter is... Bookcheekite, that's BOOKCHEEKITE. I think I did that right.
Woohoo! It's getting quicker, Ryan. You're on the ball here, man.
I think we should just pre-record this shit and then just like plug it in to every episode. Anyway,
but it's so much fun.
We have a Patreon, patreon.com/neighborscience. There you can support the show to get Peter a new mic. And you know,
socks.
The reward tiers will get you various feudal titles and the right to, you know, portions of our land holdings. You'll get your own manor if you donate over $2 a month. And if you are a dirt peasant and you don't have money because you don't work hard and you're indolent and drunk all the time, go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. Because that apparently helps us somehow. I don't know. Every other podcast says it. There's some rankings or some shit. So, you know, maybe we can accidentally be discovered by someone normal who doesn't follow me on Twitter already.
Man, I just want to be discovered by Elon Musk.
I don't. He will co-opt the shit out of anything that we say or do.
Yeah, no, he will. Okay, thank you everyone for listening, and do hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or go check out our Patreon.
Yep.
And donate, or email us.
Oh, and for whoever suggested that we do an episode on biotech and agriculture, we are planning to do that. We just haven't gotten to it yet because we have so many other ideas, you know, that are already sort of
in the barrel, or
whatever the fuck the phrase is.
I mean, don't get me wrong. We've got requests from people all over the place.
Very famous, powerful people.
Yeah.
Who talk to us all the time.
And obviously, it's just that they're more important than you. It's nothing personal or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I need to get through all of the donors that I met at the gala and their ideas before I get to any normal people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, everyone, thank you very much, and have a great week.
Bye.